dome of blue-white light sprang into existence before me, and the creature slammed into it like a brick wall. Well, more like a rickety wooden wall. I felt the shield begin to give as the creature struck it, but at least initially, it stopped it in its tracks. Billy hit it low and hard. The great, dark wolf sailed in, teeth ripping, and got hold of something. The creature howled, this time more in pain than fury, and whirled on Billy. But the leader of Chicago's resident werewolves was already on the way back out, and he bounded aside from the creature's counterattack. It was faster than Billy was. It caught him, and I saw Billy hunch his shoulders against its attack, his fur being bloodied as he crouched low, standing his ground. So that Georgia could hit it low and hard. Georgia's wolf form was dusty brown, taller and lither than Billy's, and moved with deadly precision. She raked at the creature, forcing it to turn to her, only to be forced to keep whirling as Billy went after its flank. I brandished my staff, timing my shot with my teeth gritted, and then screamed again as I sent another lance of force at the creature, aiming for its legs. The blast tore gashes in the asphalt and brought the nearly invisible thing to the ground, once more disrupting its veil. Billy and Georgia rushed toward it to keep it pinned down, and I raised my staff, calling up more energy. My next shot was going to pile-driver the thing straight down into the water table, by God. But once more, its shape turned liquid, and suddenly a hawk with a wingspan longer than my car tore into the air, reptilian yellow eyes glaring. It soared aloft, its wings beating twice, and vanished into the night sky. I stared after that for a second, then I said, "Oh, crap." I looked around in the wildly dancing light of my amulet and rushed toward Andy. She was unconscious, her body reverted to its human form, that of a redhead with a killer figure. One entire side of her body was a swelling purple bruise. She had a broken arm, shoulder, ribs, and her face was so horribly damaged that I had to worry about her skull as well. She was breathing, barely. The shapeshifter had been strong. Georgia arrived at my side in wolf form, her eyes, ears, and nose all alert, scanning around us, above us. I turned my head to see Billy, nude and in human form, crouched over Kirby. I lifted my light and moved a couple of steps over toward him so I could see. Kirby's throat was gone. Just gone. There was a scoop of flesh as wide as my palm missing, and bare vertebrae showed at the back of it. The edges of the gaping wound were black and crumbling, as if charred to black dust. Kirby's eyes were glassy and staring. His blood was everywhere. "Hell's bells," I breathed. I stared at the dead young man, a friend, and shook my head hard once. "Billy, come on. Andy's still alive. We can't leave her out here. We've got to get her behind your threshold and get her an ambulance now." Billy crouched over Kirby, his face twisted in confusion and rage. "Will!" I shouted. He looked up at me. "Andy," I said, "help me get her inside." He nodded jerkily. Then the two of us went to her. We laid my duster out on the ground and got her onto it as gently as we could. Then we picked her up and carried her back toward the apartment building. People were calling out in the buildings around us now. Flashlights and candles and chemical glow lights had begun to appear. I had no doubt that within a few minutes we'd get sirens, too. From somewhere above us, there was a contemptuous, brassy cry. The same tone I'd heard before, though modulated differently now, coming from an avian throat. "What was that?" Billy asked, his tone dull and heavy. "What was that thing?" "I'm not certain," I answered, breathing hard. Georgia was coming along behind us, dragging my staff in her jaws. "But if it's what I think it is, things just got a lot worse." Billy looked up at me, Kirby's blood all over his face and hands. "What is it, Harry?" "A Native American nightmare," I said. I looked at him grimly. "A skinwalker." Chapter 6. Georgia told the EMTs she was Andy's sister, which was true in a spiritual sense, I suppose, and rode with her in the ambulance to the hospital. The EMTs looked grim. The cops had gathered around Kirby's body and were busy closing off the scene.
I have to be here, Billy said.
I know, I said. I'm on the clock, Billy. I can't stay. I can't lose the time. He nodded. What do I need to know about skinwalkers?
They're just evil, man. They like hurting people. Shapeshifters, obviously. And the more afraid of them you are, the more powerful they get. They literally feed on fear.
Billy eyed me.
Meaning you aren't going to tell me anything more because it won't help me. You think it'll scare me?
We knew it was here. We were ready for a fight and you saw what happened, I said. If it had hit us from a real ambush, it would have been worse. He bared his teeth in a snarl. We had it. We had it at a momentary disadvantage. And it saw that, and it was smart enough to leave and come back later. All we did was prove to it that it would have to take us seriously to kill us. We won't get another opportunity like that one. I put a hand on his shoulder. You and Georgia stay close to Andy. This thing likes hurting people, and it gets off on hunting down wounded prey. She's still in danger.
Got it, he said quietly. What are you going to do?
Find out why it's here, I said. There's council business afoot.
Christ, I didn't mean to bring you into this.
I stared toward the knot of officers around Kirby's corpse.
I didn't mean for this to happen.
Kirby was an adult, Dresden, Billy said. He knew what could happen. He chose to be here.
Which was the truth.
But it didn't help. Kirby was still dead. I hadn't known what a skinwalker was before, beyond something awful, but that didn't change anything. Kirby was still dead. And Andy. God, I hadn't even thought about that part.
Andy and Kirby had been an intense item. She was going to be heartbroken, assuming she didn't die too.
Billy, I just couldn't think of him as Will, blinked tears out of his eyes and said,
You didn't know it was going to come down like that, man. We all owe you our lives, Harry. I'm glad we got the chance to be there for you.
He nodded toward the police.
I'll do the talking, then get to Georgia. You'd better go.
We traded grips, and his was crushingly tight with tension and grief. I nodded to him and turned to leave. The city lights were starting to come back on as I went out to the back entrance to Will's building, down a side street, and through an alley that ran behind an old bookstore where I wasn't welcome anymore. I passed the spot in that alley where I'd nearly died, and shivered as I did. I'd barely dodged the old man's scythe that day. Tonight Kirby hadn't. My head felt dislocated somehow. I should be feeling more than I was. I should be madder than hell. I should be shaking with fear. Something. But instead, I felt like I was observing events from a remote, cold place, somewhere up above and behind me. It was, I reasoned, probably a side effect of exposing myself to the skinwalker's true form, or rather, a side effect of what I'd had to do to get over it. I wasn't worried about the skinwalker sneaking up on me. Oh, sure, he might do it. But not cold. Supernatural beings like the Skinwalker had so much power that reality itself gets a little strained around them wherever they go, and that has a number of side effects. One of them is a sort of psychic stench that goes with them, a presence that my instincts had twigged to long before the Skinwalker had been in a position to do me any real harm. Read a little folklore, the stuff that hasn't been prettied up by Disney and the like. Start with the Brothers Grimm. It won't tell you about skinwalkers, but it will give you a good idea of just how dark some of those tales can be. Skinwalkers are dark compared to that. You've got to get the real stories from the peoples of the Navajo, Ute, and other southwestern tribes to get the really juicy material. They don't talk about them often, because the genuine and entirely rational fear the stories inspire only makes the creatures stronger. The tribes rarely talk about them with outsiders, because outsiders have no foundation of folklore to draw upon to protect themselves, and because you never know when the outsider to whom you're telling dark tales might be a skinwalker looking to indulge a sense of macabre irony. But I've been in the business a while, and I know people who know the stories. They'd confided a handful to me, in broad daylight, looking nervously around them as they spoke, as if afraid that dredging up the dark memories might catch a skinwalker's attention. Because sometimes it did. That's how bad skinwalkers are. Even amongst the people who know the danger they represent, who know better than anyone else in the world how to defend against them, no one wants to talk about skinwalkers. But in a way, it worked in my favor.
Walking down a dark alley in the middle of a Chicago night and stepping over the spot on the concrete where it had almost been ripped to pieces just wasn't spooky enough to encompass the presence of a skinwalker. If things got majorly tales from the dark side creepy and shivery, I'd know I was in real trouble. As it was, the night was simply a small figure in a lightweight Cubs jacket stepped around the corner at the end of the alley. The newly restored streetlight shone on blonde hair, and Sergeant Karen Murphy said, "Evening, Dresden."
Complicated.
"Murph," I responded woodenly. Murphy was a sergeant with Chicago PD's Special Investigations Department. When something supernaturally bad happened and the cops got involved, Murphy often contacted me to get my take on things. The city didn't want to hear about imaginary things like skinwalkers or vampires. They just wanted the problem to go away. But Murphy and the rest of SI were the people who had to make it happen. "I tip a guy down at Impound to keep an eye out for certain vehicles," Murphy said. "Pay him in bottles of McAnally's ale. He calls me and tells me your car got brought in."
"Uh-huh," I said.
Murphy fell into pace beside me as I turned out onto the sidewalk. She was 5 feet nothing, with blonde hair that fell a little past her shoulders, and blue eyes. She was more cute than pretty, and looked like someone's favorite aunt, which seemed likely. She had a fairly large Irish Catholic family.
"Then I hear about a power outage," she said, "and a huge disturbance at the same apartments where your werewolf friends live. I hear about a girl who might not make it and a boy who didn't."
"Yeah," I said. It might have come out a little bleak.
"Who was it?" Murphy asked.
"Kirby," I said.
"Jesus," Murphy said. "What happened?"
"Something fast and mean was following me. The werewolves jumped it. Things went bad." Murphy nodded and stopped, and I dimly realized that we were standing next to her Saturn, an updated version of the one that had been blown up, blithely parked in front of a hydrant. She went around to the trunk and popped it open.
"I took a look at that pile of parts you call a car."
She drew out the medical toolbox and cooler from her trunk and held them up.
"These were on the passenger seat. I thought they might have been there for a reason."
Hell's bells. In the confusion of the attack and its aftermath, I had all but forgotten the whole reason I'd gone out in the first place. I took the medical kit from her as she offered it.
"Yeah, stars and stones, yeah, Murph. Thank you."
"You need a ride?" she asked me. I'd been planning on flagging down a cab eventually, but it would be better not to spend the money if I didn't need to. Wizarding might be sexy, but it didn't pay nearly as well as lucrative careers like law enforcement.
"Sure," I said.
"What a coincidence. I need some questions answered." She unlocked the door with an actual key, not the little what's-it that does it for you automatically with the press of a button, and held it open for me with a gallant little gesture, like I'd done for her about a million times. She probably thought she was mocking me with that impersonation. She was probably right. This mess was getting stickier by the minute, and I didn't want to drag Murphy into it. I mean, Jesus. The werewolves had been capable defenders of their territory for a long while, and I'd gotten half of them taken out in the first couple hours of the case. Murphy wouldn't fare any better in the waters through which I was currently swimming. On the other hand, I trusted Murph. I trusted her judgment, her ability to see where her limits lay. She'd seen cops carved to pieces when they tried to box out of their weight division, and knew better than to attempt it. And if she started throwing obstacles in my way, and she could, a lot of them, that I couldn't do diddly about, then my life would get a whole lot harder. Even though she wasn't running CPD's Special Investigations Department anymore, she still had clout there, and a word from her to Lieutenant Stallings could hobble me. Maybe lethally. So I guess you could say that Murphy was threatening to bust me if I didn't talk to her, and you'd be right. And you could say that Murphy was offering to put her life on the line to help me, and you'd be right. And you could say that Murphy had done me a favor with a medical kit in order to obligate me to her when she told me that she wanted to be dealt in. And you'd be right. You could also say that I was standing around dithering when time was critical, and you'd be right about that too. At the end of the day, Murphy is good people. I got in the car.
"So let me get this straight," Murphy said as we approached my apartment. "You're hiding a fugitive from your own people's cops, and you think the guy's been set up in order to touch off a civil war within the White Council. And there's some kind of Navajo boogeyman loose in town, following you around and attempting to kill you, and you aren't sure they're related. More like I don't know how they're related. Yet. Murphy chewed on her lip. Is there anyone on the council who is in tight with Native American boogeymen?
Hard to imagine it, I said quietly.
Injun Joe Listens to Wind was a senior council member who was some kind of Native American shaman. He was a doctor, a healer, and a specialist in exorcisms and restorative magic. He was, in fact, a decent guy. He liked animals.
But someone's a traitor, Murphy said quietly, right?
Yeah, I said. Someone. Murphy nodded, frowning at the road ahead of her.
The reason treachery is so reviled, she said in a careful tone of voice, is because it usually comes from someone you didn't think could possibly do such a thing.
I didn't say anything in reply. In a minute, her car crunched to a stop in the little gravel lot outside my apartment. I picked up the medical kit, the cooler, and my staff, and got out of the car.
Call me the minute you know something, she said.
Yep, I told her. Don't take any chances if you see something coming. She shook her head.
They aren't your kids, Harry.
Doesn't matter. Anything you can do to protect them in the hospital.
Relax, she said. Your werewolves won't be alone. I'll see to it.
I nodded and closed my eyes for a second.
Harry?
She asked me.
Yeah? You don't look so good.
It's been a long night, I said.
Yeah, she said. Look, I know something about those.
Murphy did. She'd had more than her share of psychic trauma. She'd seen friends die, too. My memory turned out an unwelcome flash from years before. Her former partner, Carmichael, half eviscerated and bleeding to death on white, institutional tile flooring.
I'll make it, I said.
Of course you will, she said. There's a lot of ways you could deal, Harry. Some of them are better than others. I care about what happens to you, and I'm here. I kept my eyes closed in order to make sure I didn't start crying like a girl or something. I nodded, not trusting myself to speak.
Take care, Harry, she said.
You too, I said. It came out a little raspy. I tilted the toolbox at her in a wave and headed into my apartment to see Morgan. I had to admit, I hated hearing the sound of my friend's car leaving. I pushed those thoughts away. Psychic trauma or not, I could fall to little pieces later. I had work to do. Chapter 7 Morgan woke up when I opened the bedroom door. He looked bad, but not any worse than he did before, except for some spots of color on his cheeks.
Let me see to my roommates, I said. I got the goods.
I put the medical kit down on the nightstand. He nodded and closed his eyes. I took Mouse outside for a walk to the mailbox. He seemed unusually alert, nose snuffling at everything, but he didn't show any signs of alarm. We went by the spot in the tiny backyard that had been designated as Mouse's business area and went back inside. Mister, my bobtailed gray tomcat, was waiting when I opened the door and tried to bolt out. I caught him, barely. Mister weighs the next best thing to 30 pounds. He gave me a look that might have been indignant, then raised his stumpy tail straight in the air and walked haughtily away, making his way to his usual resting point atop one of my apartment's bookcases. Mouse looked at me with his head tilted as I shut the door.
Something bad is running around out there, I told him. It might decide to send me a message. I'd rather he didn't use Mister to do it.
Mouse's cavernous chest rumbled with a low growl.
Or you either, for that matter, I told him. I don't know if you know what a skinwalker is, but it's serious trouble. Watch yourself.
Mouse considered that for a moment and then yawned.
I found myself laughing. Pride goes before a fall, boy.
He wagged his tail at me and rubbed up against my leg, evidently pleased to have made me smile. I made sure both sets of bulls had food and water in them, and then went in to Morgan. His temperature was up by another half a degree, and he was obviously in pain. This isn't heavy-duty stuff, I told him, as I broke out the medical kit. Me and Billy made a run up to Canada for most of it. There's some codeine for the pain, though, and I've got the stuff to run an IV for you, saline, intravenous antibiotics. Morgan nodded, then he frowned at me, an expression I was used to from him, raked his eyes over me more closely, and asked, "Is that blood I smell on you?"
Damn. For a guy who had been beaten to within a few inches of death's door, he was fairly observant. Andy hadn't really been bleeding when we picked her up in my coat. She was only oozing from a number of gouges and scrapes, but there had been enough of them to add up.
"Yeah," I said.
"What happened?"
I told him about the skinwalker and what had happened to Kirby and Andy.
He shook his head wearily.
"There's a reason we don't encourage amateurs to try to act like wardens, Dresden."
I scowled at him, got a bowl of warm water and some antibacterial soap, and started cleaning up his left arm.
"Yeah, well, I didn't see any wardens doing anything about it."
"Chicago is your area of responsibility, Warden Dresden."
"And there I was," I said. "And if they hadn't been there to help, I'd be dead right now."
"Then you call for backup. You don't behave like a bloody superhero and throw lambs to the wolves to help you do it. Those are the people you're supposed to be protecting."
"Good thinking," I said, getting out the bag of saline and suspending it from the hook I'd set in the wall of the bed. I made sure the tube was primed. Air bubbles, bad. "That's exactly what we need, more wardens in Chicago." Morgan grunted and fell silent for a moment, eyes closed. I thought he'd dropped off again, but evidently he was only thinking.
"It must have followed me up."
"Huh?"
"The skinwalker," he said. "When I left Edinburgh, I took away to Tucson. I came to Chicago by train. It must have sensed me when the tracks passed through its territory."
"Why would it do that?
Follow an injured wizard?" he asked.
"Because they get stronger by devouring the essence of practitioners. I was an easy meal."
"It eats magic?"
Morgan nodded. "Adds its victim's power to its own."
"So what you're telling me is that not only did the skinwalker get away, but now it's stronger for having killed Kirby."
He shrugged.
"I doubt the werewolf represented much gain relative to what it already possessed. Your talents, or mine, are orders of magnitude greater."
I took up a rubber hose and bound it around Morgan's upper arm. I waited for the veins just below the bend of his elbow to pop up.
"Seems like an awfully unlikely chance encounter."
Morgan shook his head.
"Skinwalkers can only dwell on tribal lands in the American Southwest. It wasn't as if whoever is framing me would know that I was going to escape and flee to Tucson."
"Point," I said, slipping the needle into his arm.
"Who would want to go there in the summer anyway?"
I thought about it. "The skinwalker's got to go back to his home territory, though."
Morgan nodded. "The longer he's away, the more power it costs him."
"How long can he stay here?" I asked.
He winced as I missed the vein and had to try again.
"More than long enough."
"How do we kill it?"
I frowned as I missed the vein again.
"Give me that,"
Morgan muttered. He took the needle and inserted it himself, smoothly, and got it on the first try. I guess you learn a few things over a dozen decades.
"We probably don't," he said. "The true skinwalkers, the Nagloshi, are millennia old. Tangling with them is a fool's game. We avoid it."
I taped down the needle and hooked up the catheter.
"Pretend for a minute that it isn't going to cooperate with that plan."
Morgan grunted and scratched at his chin with his other hand.
"There are some native magics that can cripple or destroy it.
A true shaman of the blood could perform an enemy ghostway and drive it out. Without those, our only recourse is to hit it with a lot of raw power, and it isn't likely to stand still and cooperate with that plan, either."
"It's a tough target," I admitted. "It knows magic and how to defend against it."
"Yes," Morgan said.
He watched me pick a preloaded syringe of antibiotics from the cooler.
"And its abilities are more than equal to both of us put together."
"Jinkies," I said.
I primed the syringe and pushed the antibiotics into the IV line. Then I got the codeine and a cup of water, offering Morgan both. He downed the pills, laid his head back wearily, and closed his eyes.
"I saw one once, too," he said.
I started cleaning up. I didn't say anything.
"They aren't invulnerable. They can be killed."
I tossed wrappers into the trash can and restored equipment to the medical kit. I grimaced at the bloodied rug that still lay beneath Morgan. I'd have to get that out from under him soon. I turned to leave, but stopped in the doorway. "How'd you do it?" I asked, without looking behind me. It took him a moment to answer. I thought he'd passed out again.
"It was the 50s," he said. "Started in New Mexico. It followed me to Nevada. I lured it onto a government testing site and stepped across into the Never Never just before the bomb went off."
I blinked and looked over my shoulder at him.
"You nuked it?"
He opened one eye and smiled. It was sort of creepy.
"Stars and stones, that's..." I had to call a spade a spade. "Kind of cool."
"Gets me to sleep at night," he mumbled. He closed his eye again, sighed, and let his head sag a little to one side. I watched over his sleep for a moment, and then closed the door. I was pretty tired myself, but like the man said, "I have promises to keep," I sighed to myself.
I got on the phone and started calling my contacts on the Paranet. The Paranet was an organization I'd helped found a couple of years before. It's essentially a union whose members cooperate in order to protect themselves from paranormal threats. Most of the Paranet consisted of practitioners with marginal talents, of which there were plenty. A practitioner had to be in the top percentile before the White Council would even consider recognizing him, and those who couldn't cut it basically got left out in the cold. As a result, they were vulnerable to any number of supernatural predators, which I think sucks. So an old friend named Elaine Mallory and I had taken a dead woman's money and begun making contact with the marginal folks in city after city. We'd encourage them to get together to share information, to have someone they could call for help. If things started going bad, a distress call could be sent up the Paranet, and then I, or one of the other wardens in the U.S., could charge in. We also gave seminars on how to recognize magical threats, as well as teaching methods of basic self-defense for when the capes couldn't show up to save the day. It had been going pretty well. We already had new chapters opening up in Mexico and Canada, and Europe wouldn't be far behind. So I started calling up my contacts in those various cities, asking if they'd heard of anything odd happening. I couldn't afford to get any more specific than that, but as it turned out, I didn't need to. Of the first dozen calls, folks in four cities had noted an upswing in warden activity, reporting that they were all appearing in pairs. Only two of the next 30 towns had similar reports, but it was enough to give me a good idea of what was going on. A quiet manhunt. But I just had to wonder, of all the places the wardens could choose to hunt for Morgan, why would they pick Poughkeepsie? Why Omaha? The words "wild goose chase" sprang to mind. Whatever Morgan was doing to mask his presence from their tracking spells, it had them chasing their tails all over the place. At least I accomplished one positive thing. Establishing rumors of wardens on the move meant that I had a good and non-suspicious arousing motivation to start asking questions of my own. So next, I started calling the wardens I was on good terms with. Three of them worked for me, technically speaking, in several cities in the eastern and midwestern United States. I'm not a very good boss. I mostly just let them decide how to do their job and try to lend a hand when they ask me for help. I had to leave messages for two, but Bill Myers in Dallas answered on the second ring.
"Howdy," Myers said.
I'm serious, he actually answered the phone that way.
"Bill, it's Dresden."
"Harry," he said politely. Bill was always polite with me. He saw me do something scary once.
"Speak of the devil, he appears."
"Is that why my nose was itching?" I asked.
"Likely," Bill drawled. "I was gonna give you a call in the morning."
"Yeah, what's up?"
"Rumors," Bill said. "I spotted two wardens coming out of the local entrance to the ways. But when I asked them what was up, they stonewalled me. I figured you might know what was going on."
"Darn," I said. "I called to ask you." He snorted.
"Well, we're a fine bunch of wise men, aren't we?"
"As far as the council is concerned, the U.S. wardens are a bunch of mushrooms."
"Eh?"
"Kept in the dark and fed on bullshit."
"I hear that," Myers said. "What do you want me to do?"
Keep an ear to the ground, I told him. Captain Lucio will tell us sooner or later. I'll call you as soon as I learn anything. You do the same.
Gotcha, he said.
We hung up, and I frowned at the phone for a moment. The council hadn't talked to me about Morgan. They hadn't talked to any of the wardens in my command about him either. I looked up at Mister and said, It's almost like they want to keep me in the dark. Like maybe someone thinks I might be involved somehow. Which made sense. The Merlin wasn't going to be asking me to Christmas dinner anytime soon. He didn't trust me. He might have given the order to keep me fenced out. That wouldn't hit me as a surprise. But if that was true, then it meant that Anastasia Lucio, captain of the wardens, was going along with it. She and I had been dating for a while now. Granted, she had a couple of centuries on me, but a run-in with a body-switching psychopath several years before had trapped her in the body of a co-ed, and she didn't look a day over 25. We got along well. We made each other laugh, and we occasionally had wild monkey sex to our mutual intense satisfaction. I would never have figured Anastasia to play a game like that with me. I got on the phone to Ramirez in L.A., the other regional commander in the United States, to see if he'd heard anything, but just got his answering service. At this rate, I was going to have to go to the spirit world for answers, and that was risky in more ways than one, not the least of which was the very real possibility that I might get eaten by the same entity I called up to question. But I was running a little low on options. I pulled back the rug that lay over the trapdoor leading down to my lab, and was about to go down and prepare my summoning circle when the phone rang. I'm meeting Justine in half an hour, my brother told me. Okay, I said. Come get me.
Chapter 8 Chicago's club scene is wide and diverse. You want to listen to extemporaneous jazz? We got that. You want a traditional Irish pub, a Turkish-style coffee house, belly dancers, Japanese garden party, swing dancing, ballroom dancing, beat poetry? You're covered. You don't have to look much harder to find all sorts of other clubs, the kind that Ma and Pa tourists don't take the kids to. Gay clubs, lesbian clubs, strip clubs, leather clubs, and more subtle flavors within the genre. And then there's Zero. I stood with Thomas outside what looked like a fire exit door at the bottom of a stairway, a story below street level in the side of a downtown building. A red neon oval had been installed on the door, and it glowed with a sullen, lurid heat. The thump of a bass beat vibrated almost subaudibly up through the ground.
"Is this what I think it is?" I asked him.
Thomas, now dressed in a tight-fitting white T-shirt and old blue jeans, glanced at me and arched one dark eyebrow.
Depends on if you think it's Zero or not.
Zero is one of those clubs that most people only hear rumors about. It moves around the city from time to time, but it's always as exclusive as a popular night spot in a metropolis can possibly be. I'd been a PI in Chicago for better than a decade. I'd heard of Zero, but that was it. It was where the rich and beautiful and rich people of Chicago went to indulge themselves.
You know somebody here? I asked.
Because they aren't going to let us. Thomas popped a key into the lock, turned it, and opened the door for me. In, I finished. A wash of heat and smoke, heavy with legally questionable substances, pushed gently against my chest. I could hear the whomp, whomp, whomp of techno dance music somewhere behind the red-lit smoke.
It's a family business, Thomas explained.
He put the keys back in his pocket, an odd expression on his face.
I met Justine at Zero.
There any more of the other side of the family in there? I asked him. White court vampires were the least physically dangerous of any of the various vamps running around, and the most scary. Creatures of seduction, they fed upon the emotions and life energy of those they preyed upon. Their victims became addicted to the act and would willingly offer themselves up over and over until eventually there was nothing left to give. The poor suckers enthralled to a white court vampire were virtually slaves. Tangling with them, in any sense of the word, is a bad idea. Thomas shook his head.
I doubt it. or Justine wouldn't have chosen it to meet us here. Unless she'd been forced to do so, I thought to myself. I didn't say anything. I like to stay cozy with my paranoia, not pass her around to my friends and family. After you, Thomas said, and then he calmly stripped his shirt off. I eyed him. The club has an image they strive to maintain, he said. He might have been just a little bit smug, the bastard. His abs looked like they were added in with CGI. My abs just look like I can't afford to feed myself very well. Oh, I said. Do I need to take my shirt off, too? You're wearing a black leather coat. That's wardrobe enough. Small favors, I muttered. Then I went through the door. We walked down a hallway that got darker, louder, and more illicitly aromatic as we went. It ended at a black curtain, and I pushed it aside to reveal a few more feet of hallway, a door, and two politely formidable-looking men in dark suits standing in front of it. One of them lifted a hand and told me, "I'm sorry, sir, but this is a private..." Thomas stepped up next to me and fixed the man with a steady, gray gaze. He lowered his hand, and when he spoke, it sounded rough, as if his mouth had gone dry.
Excuse me, sir. I didn't realize he was with you.
Thomas kept staring. The bouncer turned to the door, unlocked it with a key of its own, and opened the door.
Will you be in need of a table, sir? Drinks?
Thomas's unblinking gaze finally shifted from the guard, as if the man had somehow vanished as a matter of any consequence. My brother walked by him without saying anything at all. The bouncer gave me a weak smile and said,
"Sorry about that, sir. Enjoy your evening at Zero, sir."
"Thanks," I said, and followed my brother into a scene that split the difference between a Dionysian bacchanal and a Fellini flick. There was no white light inside Zero. Most of it was red, punctuated in places with pools of blue and plenty of black lights scattered everywhere, so that even where shadows were thickest, some colors jumped out in disquieting luminescence. Cigarette smoke hung in a pall over the large room, a distance-distorting haze under the black lights. We had entered on a kind of balcony that overlooked the dance floor below. Music pounded, the bass beat so loud that I could feel it in my lower stomach. Lights flashed and swayed in synchronicity. The floor was crowded with sweating, moving bodies dressed in a broad spectrum of clothing, from full leather coverings, including a whole head hood at one extreme, to one girl clad in a few strips of electrical tape on the other. There was a bar down by the dance floor, and tables scattered around its outskirts under a 30-foot-high ceiling. A few cages hung about 8 feet over the dance floor, each containing a young man or woman in provocative clothing. Stairways and catwalks led up to about a dozen platforms that thrust out from the walls, where patrons could sit and overlook the scene below while gaining a measure of privacy for themselves. Most of the platforms were furnished with couches and chaise lounges rather than tables and chairs. There were more exotic bits of furniture up on the platforms as well. The giant X shape of a St. Andrew's cross, which was currently supporting the bound form of a young man, his wrists and ankles secured to the cross, his face to the wood, his hair falling down over his naked back. Another platform had a shiny brass pole in its center, and a pair of girls danced around it, in the middle of a circle of men and women sprawled over the couches and lounges. Everywhere I looked, people were doing things that would have gotten them arrested anywhere else. Couples, threesomes, foursomes, and nineteensomes were fully engaged in sexual activity on some of the private platforms. From where I stood, I could see two different tables where lines of white powder waited to be inhaled. A syringe disposal was on the wall next to every trash can, marked with a bright biohazard symbol. People were being beaten with whips and riding crops. People were bound up with elaborate arrangements of ropes, as well as with more prosaic handcuffs. Piercings and tattoos were everywhere. Screams and cries occasionally found their way through the music. Agony, ecstasy, joy, or rage, all indistinguishable from one another. The lights flashed constantly, changing and shifting, and every beat of the music created a dozen new frozen montages of sybaritic abandon. The music, the light, the sweat, the smoke, the booze, the drugs, it all combined into a wet, desperate miasma that was full of needs that could never be sated. That's why the place was called Zero, I realized. Zero limits, zero inhibitions, zero restraint. It was a place of perfect, focused abandon, of indulgence, and it was intriguing and hideous, nauseating and viscerally hungry. Zero fulfillment. I felt a shudder run through me. This was the world as created by the White Court. This is what they would make of it if they were given the chance. Planet Zero. I glanced aside at Thomas and saw him staring around the club. His eyes had changed hue from their usual gray to a paler, brighter silver. Actual flecks of metallic color in his eyes. His eyes tracked over a pair of young women who were passing by us, dressed in black lingerie under long leather coats and holding hands with their fingers intertwined. The women both turned their eyes toward him, as if they'd heard him call their names, and stared for a second, their steps slowing and faltering. Thomas dragged his eyes away and let that inhuman stillness fill him again. The women blinked a few times, then continued on their way, their expressions vaguely puzzled. "Hey!" I yelled through the music. "You all right?" He nodded once and then twitched his chin up to the highest platform in the building on the far side of the dance floor. "Up there." I nodded and Thomas took the lead. We negotiated the maze of catwalks and stairs. They had been purposefully designed to be just barely too narrow for two people to pass one another without touching, as I found out when Thomas and I passed a girl in leather shorts and a bustier, both of which strained to match themselves to a body whose curves were made ripe and inviting by the red light's primitive rhythm. She slid by Thomas, her eyes locked on his chest, as if she was about to lean over and bite him. He ignored her, but then the girl reached me, and I take up more room than Thomas. I felt her hip brush me, and she arched her back as I stepped past her, turned sideways. Her breasts pressed against my sternum, pliant, resilient warmth, and her lips were parted, her eyes too bright. Her hand brushed over my thigh, a touch that could have been accidental but wasn't, and my body was suddenly demanding that I stop for a moment and see where this would lead. You can't trust your body when it tells you stuff like that. It doesn't understand about things like actual affection, interaction, pregnancy, STDs. It just wants. I tried not to pay any attention to it, but there were other people on the catwalks, and evidently there was no such thing as a less than gorgeous woman inside Zero's walls. Most of them seemed perfectly happy to make sure I knew it as they went by. So did some of the men, for that matter, but that was less of an issue as far as my focus went. It probably didn't help matters that we were walking by things that I hadn't ever seen before, not even in movies. There was this one girl doing a thing with her tongue and an ice cube that... Look, just trust me on this one. It was distracting as hell. Thomas was walking faster as we approached the stairway leading up to the highest platform, and he took the last steps three at a time. I followed along behind him, scanning around me steadily, trying to be on the lookout for potential bad guys. This had the side effect of me getting to ogle more pretty girls than I'd ever seen in one place at one time. But it was professional ogling. One of them could have been concealing... Well, actually, I was sort of shocked at what one of them was concealing. I made it up to the last stairway just in time to see Thomas throw himself into a woman's arms. Justine wasn't particularly tall for a girl, or at least she hadn't been before she'd put on the boots with the 5-inch heels. She looked like I remembered her last, a gorgeous face that still fell into the girl-next-door category with a heart-melting smile. Her hair was silver-white and was being held in a tight bun up high on the back of her head with a pair of white chopsticks. Of course, the last time I'd seen her, she hadn't been dressed in a form-fitting white rubber cat suit that included gloves over her fingers. It emphasized absolutely everything and did it well. Thomas fell to his knees and wrapped his arms around her waist, drawing her to him. She twined her rubber-covered arms around his neck
and clung tightly. Both of them closed their eyes and just stood there for a long minute, embracing without moving, just holding each other close. It was an alien act in that place. I turned away, leaned on the platform safety railing, and stared down at the club, trying to give my brother and the woman he loved a moment of privacy. Justine hadn't worn the cover-everything suit for the sake of fashion. The touch of honest love, real and selfless love, was anathema to the White Court. Thomas had told me about White Court vampires who had been badly burned by the touch of some wedding rings or the brush of a sweetheart's rose. But most dangerous of all to them was the touch of someone who was loved and who loved in return. I'd seen Thomas give himself a second-degree burn on his lips and mouth the last time he'd kissed Justine. They hadn't been together since the night she had laid down her life to save his, offering herself up to his hunger so that he could survive the evening. Thomas, in return, had refused to devour her, denying his own darker nature. It had nearly killed her anyway, turning her hair white literally overnight. It had taken her years to recover her mind after a long-term addiction to being fed upon by an incubus, but she'd done it. She was currently an assistant to Thomas's older sister, Lara, and positioned to find out all kinds of juicy details about the White Court. Being protected by love meant that the vamps couldn't feed on Justine, which Lara thought ideal in a personal assistant. It also meant that my brother couldn't touch the woman he loved. If he'd been like most of the White Court, only interested in feeding his hunger, he'd have been able to have her all he wanted. Instead, sometimes irony is a lot like a big old kick in the balls. I stared down at the dance floor for a while, not so much ogling as simply taking in the light and motion as a whole, until I saw them part in my peripheral vision. Then I turned and walked over to join them as Justine gestured for us to sit on a pair of couches that had been moved to face each other. Thomas sat down in the corner of the couch, and Justine pressed up close against him, careful to keep what little of her was exposed from touching his skin. I settled down across from them, leaning my elbows forward onto my knees. I smiled at Justine and nodded to her. The floor and half-wall railing of the platform must have been made from sound-absorbing material. The roar of the club was much reduced up here. "Justine, you look like the Michelin man's wet dream." She laughed, pink touching her cheeks. "Well, the club has a look we try to maintain. How are you, Harry?" "Half buzzed on this smoke and floundering," I said. "Thomas told me you had some information." Justine nodded seriously and picked up a manila file folder from the couch beside her. "Word is out about a hunt for a renegade warden," she said. "There weren't a lot of details, but I was able to turn up this." She slid the folder over to me, and I opened it. The first page was a printout of a website of some kind. "What the hell is Craigslist?" "It's a site on the internet," Justine said. "It's sort of like a giant classified ads section, only you can get to it from anywhere in the world. People use it to advertise goods they want to buy or sell." "Goods," Thomas put in, "and services. Help wanted, with veiled language for the less legal things. A lot of shady deals happen there because it's relatively easy to do so anonymously. Escorts, mercenaries, you name it." There was an ad printed on it. "Wanted for permanent position. Donald Morgan, 5 mil finder's fee. Considerations. Lost warden found at yahoo.com. "Hell's bells," I cursed quietly. I passed the page to Thomas. "A wanted poster," he said. I nodded. "And not dead or alive, either. They just want him dead. Every supernatural hitter on the bloody planet was going to be coming after Morgan. Not so much for the money, probably, as for the favors that the ad promised. They carry a hell of a lot more weight than cash in the world of the weird. The 5 million was just there to provide scope, a sense of scale for the favors that would come with it." "Every button man in the world and his brother," I muttered. "This just keeps getting better and better." "Why would your people do that?" Justine asked. "They wouldn't," I said. Thomas frowned. How do you know?
Because the council solves things in-house, I said, which was true. They had their own assassin for jobs like this, when he was needed. I grimaced. Besides, even if they did put out a hit, they sure as hell wouldn't use the internet to do it. Thomas nodded, fingers idly stroking Justine's rubberized shoulder. Then who did?
Who indeed, I said. Is there any way to find out who put this here? Or who this email thingy belongs to?
Justine shook her head.
Not with any confidence.
Then we'll have to make contact ourselves, Thomas said. Maybe we can draw them out.
I scratched my chin, thinking. If they've got a lick of sense, they won't show themselves to anyone who isn't established in the field. But it's worth a try.
I sighed. I've got to move him.
Why? Thomas asked. I tapped the page with my finger.
When the hard cases start coming out of the woodwork, things are going to get messy, and old people live upstairs from me.
Thomas frowned and nodded.
Where?
I began to answer when the tempo of the beat suddenly changed below, and a wave of frenzied cries rolled up, deafening despite any soundproofing. A second after that, an odd frisson crawled across my nerves, and I found my heart pound a little more quickly, and the earlier demands my body had been making returned in a rush. Across from me, Justine shivered, and her eyes slid almost completely closed. She took a deep breath, and her nipples tightened against the rubber cat suit. Her hips shifted in a small, unconscious movement, brushing against Thomas's thigh. My brother's eyes flashed from light gray to cold, hard silver for a second, before he narrowed them and rose, carefully disentangling himself from Justine. He turned to face the dance floor, his shoulders tense. I followed his example.
What is it?
Trouble, he said, and looked over his shoulder at me. Families come to visit. Chapter 9. Thomas stared hard at the floor below and then nodded once as if in recognition.
Harry, he said in a steady, quiet voice, stay out of this.
Stay out of what? I asked. He turned to look at me, his expression inhumanly remote.
It's family business. It won't involve you. The house has given orders that wizards are not to be molested without clearance. If you don't get involved, I won't have to worry about you.
What? I said.
Thomas, just let me handle it, he said, his voice hard.
I was going to answer him when the vampire entered the room. It was one of those sensations you have trouble remembering afterward, like the last moments of the dream you had just before waking. You know that once you're outside the dream, you're going to forget, and you can't believe you could lose something so significant, so undeniably tangible. I turned to look the second she entered, just like everyone else in the room. She wore white, of course. A white dress. A simple shift made of some kind of glistening silken fabric, which fell to the top of her thighs. She was at least 6 feet tall, more so in the partially transparent shoes she wore. Her skin was pale and perfect, her hair dark and shining with highlights that changed color in the beat of the strobe lighting of the club. Her face was perfect beauty that remained unmarred by the obvious arrogance in her expression, and her body could have been used on recruiting posters for wet dreams. She descended to the dance floor and crossed the stairways and catwalks with a predator's easy motion, each stride making her hips roll and shoulders sway, somehow in time to the music, and far more graceful than the efforts of the sweating dancers, more sensual than the frantic lovers. At the foot of the first stairway, she came to a young man in leather pants and the scraps of a shirt that looked like it had been torn to pieces by ardent admirers. Without hesitation, she pushed him up against the railing beside the stairway and pressed her body up against his. She twined her arms slowly around his neck and kissed him. A kiss, and that was all. But apparently no one told the young man that. From his reaction, you'd have thought that she'd mounted him then and there. Her lips were sealed to his, their tongues lashing one another for maybe a minute. Then she turned away with that same precise grace and began walking up the stairs, slowly, so that every shift and change of muscle in her perfectly formed legs danced in mesmerizing ripples beneath her soft white skin. The young man simply melted onto the floor, muscles twitching, his eyes closed. I didn't think he was actually aware that she had left. The woman had every eye in the building, and she knew it. It wasn't an enormous event, the way she took the attention of everyone there. It wasn't a single large, simultaneous, significant motion when everyone turned to look. There was no sudden silence, no deepening stillness. That would have been bad enough. Her influence was a lot scarier than that. It was simply a fact, like gravity, that everyone's attention should be directed to her. Every person there, men and women alike, glanced up or tracked her movement obliquely with their eyes or paused for half a beat in their conversations. For most of them, it was an entirely unconscious act. They had no idea that their minds had already been ensnared. And as I realized that, I realized that mine was in danger too. It was a real effort to close my eyes and remind myself of where I was. I could feel the succubus's aura like the silken brush of cobwebs against my eyelashes, something tingling and delicious and fluttering that swayed up my legs and through my groin on its way to my brain. It was only a promise, a whisper to the flesh, but it was a good whisper. I had to make an effort to wall it away from my thoughts until suddenly reason reasserted itself and that fluttering haze froze and cracked and blew away under the chill wind of sensible fear. When I opened my eyes, the woman was stalking toward us along that last catwalk, slithering nearer in her thin white dress as she mounted the last few stairs. She paused there, letting us look at her, knowing what effect she was having. Even on guard against it, I could feel the subtle sweetness of her presence calling out to me, whispering that I should relax and let my eyes run over her for a while. She turned her cornflower blue eyes to me for a moment, and her mouth parted, spreading slowly into a smile that shrunk my pants about three sizes in as many seconds. "Cousin Thomas," she purred. "Still noble and starving, I see." "Madeline," Thomas replied, a small smile showing white, perfect teeth. "Still undisciplined and blatant, I see." Madeline Wraith's mouth and eyes reacted in completely different ways to my half-brother's remark. Her smile widened into a beauty pageant expression, wide and immobile, but her eyes narrowed and went completely white, the pale blue vanishing from her irises. She looked from Thomas to Justine. "Lara's little pet mortal," Madeline said. "I wondered where you were running off to. Now I find you meeting with your old flame and," her eyes slid to me, "the enemy." "Don't be ridiculous," Justine replied. Though her voice was calm, her cheeks were bright pink, her eyes dilated. "I came to go over the books the way I do every week." "But this time you wore perfume," Madeline said, "and a rather provocative ensemble. Not that you don't do it justice, darling. I find it," her tongue touched her upper lip, "interesting." "Madeline," Thomas said in a tone of exaggerated patience, "please go away." "I have every right to be here," she murmured. It didn't seem right that she should be able to keep her voice so maddeningly soft and sensual over the beat of the club's music. She turned to me and took a few steps my way with her full attention on me. I suddenly felt like a teenager, a little bit afraid, a whole lot excited, and filled with so many hormones demanding so many inexplicable things that I nearly lost the ability to focus my eyes. She stopped just out of the reach of my hand. "Don't mind my cousin's horrible manners. The infamous Harry Dresden hardly needs an introduction." She looked me up and down and twined a finger through a tendril of dark hair. "How could I come to Chicago so many times without meeting you?"
"But I've seen you," I said. My voice was a little rough, but it worked.
Oh, she asked, the sexy smile widening. Are you the sort who likes to watch, Harry?